The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Chatter. I'm David Preece. This week, historian and author Julia Irwin on the long history of U.S. foreign disaster aid.
Between the early 20th century and World War II, the American Red Cross was the U.S. government's humanitarian arm. One of the interesting things about disaster relief is that, other than Jamaica, for the most part, these things are done by the invitation and an acceptance of a government that's been affected. And when a major disaster like this happens, most countries, are keen to kind of welcome immediate assistance. What we call a natural disaster, something caused by an earthquake or hurricane, is really about human choices. An earthquake that happens in, say, Japan, which happened fairly recently, may cause relatively few casualties, less destruction than, say, an earthquake that occurs in Haiti. And that's about the political choices that people have made.
Julia Irwin, welcome to Chatter.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad you could join us and talk about one of my favorite topics, which is disasters and their recovery. That sounds horrible, doesn't it?
It really does.
We're celebrating it.
Yeah, it is unfortunately or fortunately become one of my favorite topics too. So,
how did you get there? What did you have a personal tragedy that drove you this way, or you just read about them and thought, I want to learn more?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it relatively brief, but it actually started when I was researching my dissertation, which was on the First World War. So I was interested in humanitarian aid and conflict. But as I was researching the dissertation, I kept seeing sort of instances in the archives of the American Red Cross, the U.S. government responding to what we often call natural disasters, to earthquakes, to hurricanes, to floods in other parts of the world. And so as I kind of finished up that book, about a decade ago, the dissertation and my first book, I decided for the next project to turn my attention away from wartime disasters and to peacetime disasters. And that's where it all began.
Is there a wide and deep community of historians who look at this topic, or is your work as unique as it appears to me?
There's a growing number. And, I think I wrote the book because it hadn't been written. But I really think of myself as kind of existing in a couple of different circles, I think. One is historians who work on humanitarian aid. And there's a growing number of people, especially over the last decade or so, who really are historians of humanitarian aid internationally, of U.S. foreign assistance as well. And then there's a group of people who we often call ourselves disaster studies scholars. So historians of disaster, but also sociologists, anthropologists, people in other fields as well. So I kind of think of it as sort of the intersection of these two fields, as disaster studies and the history of humanitarianism.
And it is related to the former topic there, but different, right? You're not focused on all foreign aid, which takes into account all kinds of things and isn't nearly as focused. You really do focus, at least most recently, on natural disasters and aid to recover and then development afterward, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So in this book, I'm very interested in sort of sudden emergencies, again, earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, these very sort of sudden events that can change the course of history, can change the course of people's lives, and often more than, no more than an instant. And so these specific types of disasters, which I think in our kind of popular imagination There's disaster movies. There's this sort of this obsession, I think, that's longstanding with things like volcanic eruptions and the fate of Pompeii. And I think they've been seen differently in American culture and kind of culture globally from other types of crises, for better or for worse. They've been treated differently for that reason, both kind of in the popular imagination, but also in policy planning circles. There's also good reasons for this, right? The types of suffering that are caused, you know, by this sudden kind of catastrophic event are different from the long-term effects of famine, of disease, of poverty, for that matter, of war. So some of the kind of legal and cultural differences that separate disasters from other type of crises interest me as well.
Some of it feels just personal. That is, I can imagine people across many generations looking at, let's say, news of foreign wars and saying, well, those are choices that those people and those governments are making. And there's almost less empathy because of what comes from the war. Whereas an earthquake or an outbreak of tornadoes or a tsunami or flooding, you know, any of these things, you could picture those things happening to you. And many of us, they have happened to us or near us. So there's almost a different mental framework for the way we think about those.
Yeah, there really are. And I think, you know, one of the more interesting ideas coming out of disaster studies is the sense that there is really no such thing as a natural disaster. So what we call a natural disaster, something caused by an earthquake or hurricane, is really about human choices. And by that, it means that an earthquake that happens in, say, Japan, which happened fairly recently, may cause relatively few casualties, less destruction than, say, an earthquake that occurs in Haiti. And that's about the political choices that people have made about earthquake planning and zoning and how to make earthquake-resistant housing, early warning systems, all of these sort of technologies that we can use if we choose, or if we have the resources to choose, to help prevent populations from suffering long term. That being said, right, as you point out, every day people thinking about these do see them as different. They empathize with the suffering. I think a lot of times disaster survivors are seen as much more blameless for their own suffering than survivors of other types of crises. That those moral decisions to provide aid are often less contested than they are for other types of humanitarian crises as well.
Yeah, I do want to come back to some of those issues of, you know, cultural representations, pop culture about disasters, but we'll do that after we've actually laid the foundation of the real history, as you've detailed in the book you've mentioned, Catastrophic Diplomacy, U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance in the American Century. It's an interesting take because so many of us have a currency bias. That is, we see the world as it is now and in recent history, and we think, well, this is what's new and different. This is what matters. But you've done a service by looking and saying that, no. When it comes to foreign disaster assistance in the United States, that it has a much longer history than is commonly believed. You go all the way back to James Madison. And even as a student of the U.S. presidency and looking at a lot of U.S. foreign policy issues related to the presidency, I have to say, it had never occurred to me that it would go back to the Madison administration that the United States would provide foreign aid to a natural disaster to another country. I mean, we were barely functioning as a government in some important ways at that point. So what was the incident in 1812, and how did the U.S. respond?
Yeah, so believe me, I was as surprised as you are, and some of what I've found and learned in the process. In 1812, there was a major earthquake in Caracas in Venezuela and the surrounding areas. This is an interesting moment in world history. Venezuela had declared their independence from Spain recently. It's this beginning of this wave of revolutions against the Spanish Empire throughout much of Central and South America. And Americans were watching, U.S. Americans and the United States were kind of aware of what's going on. And then this major earthquake happens that destroys Caracas. Americans didn't learn about it for quite a while. It takes a long time in 1812 for news of complete destruction of a city to reach U.S. ports by ship. But when it did, when news did arrive in Washington, it really sparked a lot of discussion in Congress. Reading the congressional documents from that time, there's a lot of conversation about whether the United States should aid Venezuelans or not. And ultimately, the the majority decision was yes, the United States should provide some assistance to survivors of this crisis. For some, at least rhetorically, it was a duty to humanity, this idea that Americans owed it to each other. There were certainly Pan-American sentiments swirling around this sort of this age of revolutions, and concern for other potential revolutionaries inspired a lot of Americans to provide assistance. Some saw it as a way to help support a fellow would-be republic without alienating Spain too much. This idea that if you provide aid in a disaster, it's different from providing, say, aid to revolutionaries fighting a war against a major empire. For all of these reasons, moral and strategic, made the decision to commit $50,000 and send shiploads of food and other aid to Venezuela. Of course, it arrived long after the actual disaster had occurred. Sure. It's, I think, about 3 months before the aid actually reached there, just because of the timing and everything like that. But it marked the first instance of the U.S. government making a contribution of assistance to survivors of a foreign disaster.
And in there, you've previewed several themes that I think we'll hit on and notice the changes temporally here. You've touched on strategic, that there is a political issue here, not just a humanitarian one. But there are perceptions of humanitarian assistance and the role of the U.S. government in helping in foreign countries, which comes up. There's the issues of transportation and technology that come up. So these themes will be coming back. You note that for most of the rest of the 19th century, however, the U.S. government was not consistently providing major U.S. foreign disaster aid, that it wasn't until the 1880s and really the 1890s that a confluence of factors came together that led to a turn that allowed what we'll get to, which is a massive case from 1902. But in the 1880s, 1890s, it actually had started because of several factors relating to technology, transportation, U.S. interests. Talk through a few of those and help us understand what changed in the last couple of decades of the 19th century to set up what you call the American century of disaster assistance.
Yeah, so throughout much of the 19th century, after the 1812 earthquake, the federal government remains quite small. It doesn't have a very large overseas footprint. There are not that many diplomats and consuls abroad. There are not that many U.S. embassies. The U.S. military remains quite small, relatively speaking. Starting in the last quarter or so of the 19th century, a lot of that begins to change. The U.S. government after the Civil War becomes stronger and more centralized. It begins to engage with other nations and empires in a way that it hadn't. You start to see the number of diplomats and consuls increasing in various parts of the world, especially by the 1890s. There's a commitment to building up the U.S. Navy. And by all accounts, the U.S. becomes an overseas empire in 1898. So following the Spanish-American War, the U.S. government maintains control of Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and militarily occupies Cuba until the early 20th century, and then retains control over Guantanamo Bay. So this really changes the U.S. government's overseas footprint. All of a sudden, you have both diplomats and military forces stationed around the world in ways they hadn't been before. You have a permanent presence of the U.S. military in the Philippines, in Puerto Rico, in Guantanamo. Within a few years, this would also extend to the Canal Zone in Panama, following the U.S. acquisition of that territory. And suddenly, you just have people on the scene. So when disasters in other places occur, there's more likely to be someone there ready to respond. If they're not sort of there on the ground, there's a greater likelihood than there had been in the 19th century that the U.S. Navy will be able to get there more quickly, that news will be able to spread more quickly as well. And again, this issue of technology really interests me, that, sort of telegraph wires make it possible for right. someone in Washington to know that a disaster has happened, not in weeks, but in, hours or days in some cases.
Yeah, that technology side is fascinating. It's about communication. It's about information, right? You could hear about it more quickly. So it feels more real, perhaps, than in previous centuries, where it was almost like that's something that happened in the past, not something that's happening now. Mm-hmm. But also the ability to respond, right? Mm-hmm. Steamships, getting there faster. It reminds me of some of the good histories that have been written about the impact of railroads on so many issues having to do with economics and society. But for disaster relief, it obviously is a real issue. There's also the creation of an organization that I think we take for granted. And mm-hmm. at least for me as an American, it mm-hmm. never occurred to me that there wasn't the American Red Cross, mm-hmm. but it was created in this time period, right? Sometime in the 1880s.
That's right. Yeah. And my first book actually was about the American Red Cross and its role, especially in World War I, but its role as essentially the humanitarian arm or auxiliary of the U.S. government. We don't tend to realize this now, I think, in the 21st century. But between the early 20th century and World War II, the American Red Cross was the U.S. government's humanitarian arm. The American Red Cross was founded in 1881. The U.S. was actually a late entry into the International Red Cross Movement, which was founded in the 1860s. But in 1881, the American Red Cross was founded by a woman named Clara Barton, who many of us learn about in elementary school. It took, though, another 20 years or so before Congress granted the American Red Cross its first charter. So it was chartered by Congress in 1900 and then again in 1905. And it's really at this point, the early 20th century moving forward, that the American Red Cross becomes this really powerful partner to the U.S. government in foreign assistance, not only for disasters, but also in times of war. In the early 20th century, following this charter, its headquarters were actually in the State War and Navy Building. So literally right down the hallway from, yep. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, was the American Red Cross's offices. They remained there until World War I when they built their own permanent headquarters building in D.C., which was conveniently just a couple of blocks away. But the American Red Cross's leaders collaborate and really are in intense discussions with U.S. government officials whenever disasters occur in other places. They exchange information about the American Red Cross receives from the State Department information about what's going on, about the U.S.'s strategic interests in these regions, whether it would be in the national interest to respond. And then the American Red Cross, in turn, raises money from the public, has disaster experts who become involved, and really partners with the government to respond to all of these issues. So, mm-hmm. yeah, so its founding and especially its achieving this congressional charter in the early 20th century really transform the U.S. government's ability to respond to disasters abroad.
And this all sets up the first big case that I want to talk about, and this is the 1902 explosion, the volcanic eruption of Mount Pelee and Martinique in the Caribbean, which reading about now, it's just shocking that this isn't better known, with, at least 30,000 people dead and over 50,000 people who had to flee the capital and the areas around it, and close enough to the U.S. that there was this feeling, because of what we just talked about, the technology and all of this, that we can do something. So talk a little bit about the immediate reaction to this. And then what I found fascinating is the debate over what responsibility do we have as Americans to help others, and how much do we need to commit to it?
Yeah. So 1902, it's 90 years since the Caracas earthquake. And these trends that I was sort of talking about earlier in the late 19th century, early 20th century, the expansion of the U.S.'s overseas footprint, its acquisition of territories, the growth of the U.S. federal government, all of these together will really shape the U.S.'s response to this crisis. Theodore Roosevelt has recently become president in 1902 following the assassination of McKinley. And when this volcanic eruption happens, news comes pretty quickly from the Caribbean to the United States, and it really becomes this sensational story. American news headlines all over the country are reporting about this tragedy. They're comparing it to a modern day Pompeii, and they're captivated by what's happening in the region. Once again, you have a lot of people in Congress who become very interested in this disaster, and they debate whether the United States should respond. There are some who argue that it shouldn't. They say this is not the federal government's responsibility to spend American tax dollars in this way. The United States should be focusing on its own citizens, not the citizens of another empire. Martinique was a part of the French Empire as well. But the majority disagree. Much like in Caracas 90 years earlier, they say that the United States has a humanitarian obligation to aid these people. Others argue that it's a way for the United States to show itself as one of the great powers by providing assistance to France, this potential ally. The United States can demonstrate its amity towards the French Empire, towards other people in the Caribbean. By responding to this disaster, it can show the strength of its government, of its military. And so for these reasons, Congress passes a fairly substantial aid package to Martinique. It's $200,000 worth of assistance. Theodore Roosevelt had actually asked for more. He had asked for $500,000, and it was kind of negotiated down. But this allows the United States to send ships loaded with military supplies and other aid, so rations and kind of food. Some of them go from the United States, but others are going from U.S. territories in the Caribbean. So this proximity from places like Puerto Rico and Guantanamo allows the United States to get aid there relatively quickly. In this case, the United States actually comes to the American Red Cross and asks them for help as well. But it's this transitional period where the American Red Cross is still, it has just gotten its first congressional charter, and it's not quite the large organization that it would become. So the American Red Cross ends up not participating very extensively in this disaster, but the U.S. government does partner with other organizations, the New York Merchants Association, for instance, to respond to this crisis. Theodore Roosevelt, meanwhile, is writing to his counterparts in France, as is the Secretary of State. So they're really kind of making these diplomatic connections about this disaster, too.
What's interesting to me is that you can totally recognize the political debate, right? This is what we propose. This is the executive taking action and Congress, haggling over the amounts and all of this. What I don't get a good sense of, and I guess this is your job as a historian, but it's hard, is figuring out what the public opinion, the societal reaction was. Obviously, there was some reaction to the event itself, but do you have any sense of how the public viewed this as a somewhat different, right? That there had been aid before, but not at this scale. How did the public react to the government acting on their behalf, devoting so much in terms of energy and human resources to this disaster?
Yeah. One of the interesting things about researching in this period, it probably happens today as well, but a lot of people sit down and write letters to their representatives. A lot of times they write letters to the Secretary of State directly, as well as to the president. So there's these really...
You don't do that every day, Julia? Because that's how I spend most of my time.
Written letters in cursive, beautiful cursive. Right. So there's, in a lot of these disasters, you really, it's not public opinion polls, but you can certainly get a sense of what many of the American public are kind of thinking. There's also a lot of editorials. So a lot of newspapers publishing editorials about the sense of whether the U.S. should respond. And again, by and large, much like in Congress, there are debates and there are people who are making this argument that, no, this is, these are our tax dollars. The United States shouldn't be responding. But the majority of those voices that I saw were much more in support, saw this as a reasonable way for, again, in the interests of humanity, saw this as part of the United States' really obligations as a world power. There's a lot of that sense there, too. And I think a lot of this is spurred, again, by just the popular obsession in some ways with this disaster. It's hard to kind of convey what those newspaper headlines looked like, but every day for weeks, The Martinique eruption was headline news. And part of that is the people who were affected by it were initially cut off. There's this sense of you know, nobody really knows entirely what had happened. They knew there had been this large volcanic eruption that clearly, you know, people were affected. Probably a lot of people were killed. But news kind of starts creeping in gradually about numbers, about deaths, about what had happened. And people are really paying attention. After the disaster leaves the headlines, it continues to be reported on in mass market magazines. And I think what's most fascinating is that, I don't know when it opened, but shortly after, you could go to Coney Island and you could ride a ride that was about the Mount Pelee eruption. So it enters the popular imaginary and this just really kind of, it becomes this this disaster that really captivates the public's attention. And for that reason, you know, I think a lot of people are eager to give. And maybe we can talk about this a little bit later, but there are certain disasters that do this for whatever reason. Maybe it's about timing. Maybe it's just about, you know, the proximity. It's about the sense of connection. It depends. But some disasters really do spark the imagination of the American populace in ways that others don't and make people more interested and willing to aid as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, even in this conversation, I guarantee you there'll be some listeners who hear some of the cases we talk about and say, oh yeah, you know, that one resonates with me.
Yeah.
And even, you know, exceedingly well-educated students of the world, people who have traveled around, there will probably be some that people said, huh, you know, I may vaguely remember that, but for some reason it just doesn't stick. And there's one of those we'll get to soon, which I was a bit surprised by. I think I, in my best moments, I want to say, yeah, sure, I was aware of that, but I honestly don't remember any of the details. So you re-educated me about a major world event that I certainly wasn't alive for, but I feel like I should have known more about because of just being generally aware. One of the aspects of this that we haven't touched on yet is the recipient side. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's this urge growing among Americans in the government and these three pillars that you, as a historian, impose order on these events by saying, well, you have to look at these pillars of the diplomatic response through the State Department and its agents. You have to look at the military response through much of this time through the War Department and the Navy Department, eventually the Department of Defense. And then you need to look at the U.S. government's cooperation with, delegation to, whatever you want to call it, with voluntary organizations, primarily the American Red Cross, but as you pointed out with Martinique, not exclusively with the American Red Cross. But that's all on, if you will, our side, the American side and the decision to do it and how to implement it. But the recipient side, it seems easy and also naive to think, well, everybody will just be perfectly happy to have the Americans come in and help. But the case of Jamaica in 1907 showed that wasn't the case. Massive earthquake hitting Kingston. What were the diplomatic troubles involved in the aid there?
Yeah, the Jamaica incident, as it became known. Actually, I learned about this quite early in the research. There had been a really terrific article in Diplomatic History written a number of years ago that kind of called attention to this disaster as well. I wrote about parts of it, too, for the book. But essentially, in a nutshell, in 1907, so 5 years after Martinique, there's a major earthquake in Kingston in Jamaica, which is at that point a British colony. And, you know, it initially follows a very similar trajectory as the U.S. response to Martinique. The U.S. government is interested in responding. There's Navy forces stationed fairly nearby in U.S. territories who go to Kingston to offer assistance. The best we can tell is that there was a little bit of miscommunication when the U.S. Navy arrives. The governor at the time his name was Swettenham, had retired to his mansion sort of outside the city to escape all that was going on. And his, you know, right-hand man talks to the U.S. Navy and says, oh, yeah, you can, you know, thanks for your, you know, we appreciate your assistance. You're welcome to come and assist. So the U.S. Navy lands several hundred sailors, and they begin taking part in relief efforts. They include, you know, helping to dig people out from the rubble and providing aid, but also things like helping to put down a prison mutiny So you have armed U.S. sailors who are essentially policing prisoners who are trying to escape. It's you know, a lot of chaos in the midst of all this. They're at some points also destroying buildings that look like they're about to fall over in their minds because it's safer. So all of this is sort of happening. And then the governor gets wind of this and really becomes quite irate, says, you know, I did not give my permission for you to land you know, several hundred armed U.S. sailors in this territory. He has this very kind of caustic remarks. You know, what would have happened if the British Navy had landed in New York, or recently the 1906 San Francisco earthquake had happened? And so he kind of makes these arguments that, you know, you can't land on our territory without my permission, right? This is a sovereign territory. This is not, you know, a place the United States can invade. So it leads to this. Essentially leads to this major diplomatic imbroglio, kerfuffle, whatever you want to call it, between the U.S. and the U.K. Roosevelt and his State Department and their counterparts in Britain are going back and forth about, you know, who should apologize for this incident. And Roosevelt is very steadfast that the United States must not apologize. And it's really this mess that kind of occurred essentially because of, by all accounts, miscommunication over whether the U.S. Navy was allowed to land or not.
Yeah, it's a weird mix, like all of these events of the personal and the grand strategic at the same time. So you have these issues of empire and pride and sovereignty, but also just, I don't want to say peevishness, but it certainly just seems like the wrong person perceiving something the wrong way makes a huge difference and has a cascading effect on.
Absolutely. You
know. Well, the big event I referred to earlier that I would like to say I knew about, but I can't recall the details, and I think it's sad that my memory isn't this good, was the Southern Italian earthquake and tsunami of 1908, which, reading the details of it, it's absolutely tragic and devastating, both for the southern tip of the Italian mainland, but especially for northern Sicily. Talk about the events there and how so many of these elements we've talked about really came together and led to, if you will, a longer mission than most of these previous efforts in terms of rebuilding and employing survivors.
The Messina earthquake really is the largest and longest U.S. international disaster relief operation in history. So this occurs in late 1908, right after, you know, it's late December 28th, 29th. And essentially a major earthquake occurs in the Strait of Messina, which is the waterway that separates Sicily from the mainland of Italy. This underwater earthquake creates a major tsunami, which just washes out Messina, Reggio di Calabria, as well as a lot of surrounding towns and villages. Hundreds of thousands of people are killed immediately by the tsunami, by crumbling buildings. The devastation is just appalling, right? It's really hard to kind of wrap our heads around some of these things. This is a really interesting moment. So Roosevelt has just been, he's leaving office after his second term, and Taft has just been elected, but he won't be inaugurated until March, based on the earlier calendars. So it's at this moment in Roosevelt's kind of lame duck period that the U.S. decides to respond. And this disaster, even more so than the one in Martinique, really, really captures the public's imagination. This occurs, it's about 2.5 years after the great San Francisco earthquake of 1906. A lot of Americans and the public are kind of seeing this disaster in Italy through the eyes of people who have just lived through one of their own worst national disasters. There's a large Italian-American community in the United States at this point. This is kind of this era when you have a large-scale Italian immigration to the United States, many from southern Italy. So there are a lot of people who have relatives, friends in the region. There's also just a lot of what we might call Italophilic Americans who are really interested in all things Europe and all things Italy and what's going on. And for all these reasons, just the public response is really extraordinary. The American Red Cross by this point has become a more established organization, but this disaster really helps the organization make its mark in foreign disaster relief. They launch a fundraising campaign which Roosevelt supports. And it brings in just a really astounding amount of money within a short period of time. The Roosevelt administration essentially urges the American public to donate all of its money, not to small regional groups or to their churches, but to funnel all that money into the American Red Cross. And a lot of people do. Not everyone, but many people do. So the American Red Cross amasses really large-scale donations. Congress as well will commit $800,000 to the disaster, which doesn't sound like all that much today, but at the time was a fairly significant outpouring for citizens of another country. And all of this allows the U.S. to really administer this large program of not only relief, but what actually becomes rebuilding and reconstruction. So for the first month or so after the disaster, a lot of the focus is on short-term emergency relief. The U.S. sends agents to the region who are distributing food and trying to assist. In a matter of really fortuitous timing, the Great White Fleet arrives on the scene. So Roosevelt, a year before, had sent the Atlantic Fleet on this famous worldwide mission of to spread goodwill and to show the power of the U.S. Navy. They happen to be heading through the essentially through the Suez Canal about when this earthquake occurs. So they're just a few days away, and the commander sends four battleships and some auxiliary ships to assist as well. So the Navy shows up, and Navy sailors are helping to dig people out of the rubble. All of this is happening in the kind of early first few weeks after the disaster. Once the immediate emergency starts to subside, though, a few weeks later, there's still a lot of money left. And the ambassador at the time, the State Department, Congress, the American Red Cross, everyone was saying, well, what should we do with all of this extra money? And they end up deciding to use it for reconstruction and rebuilding projects, or at least temporary housing projects. The New York Times really saw this as one of the headlines I remember seeing was that this is an innovation in relief, this idea that you would actually spend money to build houses and not just to provide short-term shelter. But they end up doing a number of things. Congress, congressional donation helps to fund a number of shiploads of lumber, as well as some carpenters from the United States that are sent to southern Italy to help rebuild houses. They build a hotel, they build schools, they build a hospital as well. They build an orphanage for children. And I should note that the United States was not the only country doing this. It was one of several other countries, mostly European countries, that are also building their own sort of, they often call them villages. There's the Swiss village and the American village and the Russian village. But this idea of kind of helping to build temporary housing in the region becomes part of the relief effort. It ends up lasting about 6 months after the original earthquake, but it's a pretty extraordinary just amount of involvement in this other country's relief and rebuilding efforts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten eight others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
And as compared to the Jamaican case we just mentioned, was there any diplomatic trouble, either from the Italian government or conflicts with any of these other international efforts going on?
Yeah, I would say not quite as blatant as in Jamaica, but yeah, very much. And I think one of the interesting things about disaster relief in this case, but also in so many others, is that other than Jamaica, for the most part, these things are done by the invitation and an acceptance of a government that's been affected. So typically, the U.S. government does not simply, you know, rush in and then, you know, invade with assistance, as it was perceived to have happened in Jamaica. But there's an offer of assistance made to the Italian government, which says yes, and allows this U.S. aid to come in, another foreign aid. And when a major disaster like this happens, many countries, most countries, are keen to kind of welcome immediate assistance. One of the things I've noticed in researching is that those sort of early days after a disaster, when the immediate assistance is coming in and everyone is sort of in a state of shock and in real dire need, there tends to be kind of less tensions, less problems. But the longer these things kind of continue, the more tensions and disagreements arise. And this was certainly the case in Italy. Mm-hmm. by a few weeks in, you start to see kind of some tension, some conflicts between, say, the U.S. Navy and the Italian Navy, the Italian military as well, who is trying to kind of regain control over, you know, its own disaster relief efforts and not wanting to be overshadowed by the U.S. and other nations' navies. One of my favorite sort of sources was finding a logbook of the U.S. Navy ships that are there. And essentially, this logbook has the punishments for sailors who have done things. So a lot of them are getting drunk. They're going on shore leave and they're getting drunk and who knows what they're doing. Some of them are getting arrested. It's not really the best, way to make a good impression on people you're supposed to be helping by essentially treating it as a party. So for these reasons, tensions start to grow. There's also just a lot of condescension, not by all, but by a lot of American diplomats towards the people they're supposed to be assisting.
And not just perceived condescension, there's actual condescension.
Yes, very blatant, and especially in private correspondence, but you can imagine this sort of coming out in people's interactions as well. But this is a time when, as I mentioned, there's large-scale Italian immigration to the United States. Many people in the United States, many sort of Anglo-Americans, see Italians and especially Southern Italians as ethnically inferior, and they talk about them in their writings. They talk about the laziness and the idleness of people who have just suffered this major disaster, but talk about it as if it's part of the Italian character, the Sicilian character. So there's a lot of really derogatory remarks and beliefs that Italians are not doing enough to aid their own recovery. These pompous attitudes on the part of some, not all, but some of the U.S. diplomats involved really alienate a lot of people on the scene as well for good reason.
And that's a tension that has never gone away. I mean, we hear it even today when we talk about relief efforts, domestic as well as international, is, what's the burden on the collective to help people help themselves versus how much do they need to, in the old phrase, pull up the bootstraps and do it. Absolutely. That doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. We mentioned a bit, the rise in U.S., global presence and international interests really beginning in the 1880s, but it really took off with the First World War and the aftermath. What was the effect of the First World War on U.S. foreign disaster assistance?
Yeah, so the First World War changes everything about American society. And you had mentioned, and I appreciate you mentioning these three pillars of disaster aid that I really structure the book around, which are the State Department and its agents, the U.S. military, and then especially the American Red Cross, but other partners in the voluntary sector. During World War I, each of these really transform in profound ways. The U.S. military becomes this major mobilization of the U.S. military after U.S. entry into the war in 1917 changes certainly the shape of the U.S. military. And although it will become much smaller once the war ends, it really does have this kind of longer term effect. The U.S. government begins to play more of a role in world affairs in World War I and in ways that it was beginning to do in the early 20th century. But involvement in the First World War really cements the U.S.'s standing as a world power and a major player in European affairs and world affairs more broadly. The American Red Cross during this conflict, this is really the conflict that transforms the American Red Cross from an important player in U.S. foreign assistance to the essential kind of organization. During the war, the American Red Cross becomes the nation's just largest humanitarian organization. Millions of Americans join the organization. They give extraordinary levels of money. It's something like 400, and this is for the time, $400 million donated over the course of the war to the American Red Cross. And I remember learning this when I was writing my first book and
massive,
saying,
given
that can't be right.
Value 100 years ago. Yeah.
Yes. So it's this really extraordinary, and it changes the American Red Cross's ability to operate even after the war. And so all of these sort of events together sort of change each of these parts of the government and its auxiliaries and the ways that they're able to respond to disasters in other nations too. So it's this kind of watershed moment as the Second World War will be later as well.
In the interwar period, there's two things I'd like to get your take on. One is the somewhat different pulls going on. One pull, of course, is in the very late 20s, 30s, the Great Depression and the dampening effect that has on the ability and willingness to help people worldwide when there's so much suffering within the United States. But at the same time, you have the good neighbor policy, as it was called, that is this effort to actually reach out to and be more friendly to the countries within the Western Hemisphere, as opposed to what had happened in the previous decades of at least perceived and in most cases actual U.S. over-paternalism, we'll call it. So on one hand, I'd like you to talk about the tension between those and how that affected foreign assistance. And then outside of the hemisphere, of course, one of the greatest natural disasters in the last 100 years, I think it is about 100 years right now, which was the great Kanto earthquake in Japan in 1923, and how those dynamics played out during a period where you had this weird confluence of factors from the rise of U.S. global influence after the First World War to the retrenchment to this still feeling of good neighborly policy, and then eventually the Depression, even though that hadn't kicked in 23. So talk through this whole interwar period using those as your real, you know, marks for what was going on.
Yeah, there's a sense, I think, in the popular imagination that the 1920s and 30s are this period of American isolationism from world affairs. I think the story we often are told in you know, high school history classes and that we often tell ourselves is that after World War I, people retreated from Wilsonianism and became isolated until World War II convinced them to come back onto the scene. And that's an obviously simplistic reading. But in reality, it's, you know, I think historians today tend to concur that this is much too simplistic a reading. To be sure, the United States pulled back on some of the broader commitments that the Wilson administration had urged them to take, especially most notably participation in the League of Nations. But the United States remained involved in world affairs in all sorts of ways during the 1920s and 1930s. It was the world's largest leading economic power after the war. The role of bankers and financiers and trade keep the United States connected to the world. American missionaries are involved in parts of the world. American companies are exporting their products and their goods. And there are a lot of American diplomats and politicians who are involved in world affairs in different ways. They're involved in movements for ending war. The outlawry of war movement is really prominent in the 20s and 30s. And they're involved in diplomatic conferences, most notably the Washington Naval Conference, which happens shortly after World War I in Washington. So this is all sort of to begin this lead off by saying that the United States was never isolated from world affairs in the interwar period. And this was very true when it came to disaster relief as well. After the war ends, the United States kind of returns and starts to build on these foundations that had been laid in the early 20th century. And if anything, starts providing more disaster assistance more often to other countries and nations, especially during the 1920s. And Japan becomes one of these really, really amazing examples of this. And the Japanese story is a really fantastic one. I'll start there.
It is so fascinating too, just because the dynamics are different than with so many others, right? With Jamaica and Martinique and Italy, the United States had, I don't know what you want to say, a friendly relationship or at least a neutral one. But with Japan, there were rising tensions already, as the Naval Conference, you know, highlighted in some ways. And you had some real issues that I hope you'll talk about involving how that affected distribution of aid.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it is this really interesting moment. Japan is also a rising world power, much like the United States. And there's a lot of, in the post-World War I period, a lot of debates, discussions, you know, about what Japan's role in world affairs will be. Many Japanese diplomats and then politicians felt slighted after the Washington Naval Conference, which essentially granted more power and recognition to other great powers over Japan in terms of the size of the Navy it was allowed to keep. This is also a period in the United States where many Americans are lobbying vociferously against Japanese immigration and immigration more broadly, but really trying to bar further Japanese immigration to the United States. There's a lot of anti-Japanese racism and protests, especially on the West Coast. So this disaster occurs in this context in September 1923. And in a somewhat surprising turn of events, Americans rush to provide aid to this disaster. There's a historian named J. Charles Schenking who has written a wonderful book on the Great Kanto earthquake, and he's actually working on a book on the American response to it. So he's, I have a chapter in my book, but he's working currently on a full book, which I'm really looking forward to. And he's written a few articles. But as he and I write about, this disaster by dollar amounts is unmatched to this day, how much the American public ended up giving to this disaster. Americans give millions and millions of dollars to assist the survivors of this earthquake. The U.S. government under Calvin Coolidge, who has just become president a few weeks before, becomes incredibly involved. They send U.S. military supplies from the Philippines, a U.S. territory. They send ships from the Philippines as well as from the United States to assist survivors there. The American Red Cross, again, raises something like $11 million for this aid effort. And all of this really helps to, they're buying up food, they're shipping supplies, just this outpouring of aid from the United States. One of the interesting things in this disaster, though, is as the aid starts to arrive, the U.S. ambassador at the time is actually, I think he was one of, the more really interesting characters that I was able to kind of learn about and study in this book. And he really has this awareness, unlike a lot of his compatriots, of the complexities of the issue, the issues. He's certainly not... He, I think, is much more respectful of the Japanese people, of the Japanese government, of Japanese interests than many of his fellow Americans. Compared to that ambassador in Italy, he's actually much more culturally sensitive as well. And he kind of realizes early on that, if he has this sort of statement, if the United States comes in the way it often does and just, tries to take over the aid effort, this is going to be really perceived as a slight, and we need to hold back. We need to essentially partner with the Japanese government. We need to listen to what their needs, their desires are. We don't need to land a bunch of people ashore without permission. We need to kind of follow the Japanese government's lead. And in large part, they do, especially kind of early on. All this aid begins to arrive, but most of it is turned over to the Japanese government and the Japanese Earthquake Relief Bureau, unlike in a lot of other disasters where American officials demand to kind of have control over the aid that is distributed. They make the decision to give up that control. And it really does help to cultivate this sense of amity. There's a lot of discussion, both from U.S. government officials, but also their Japanese counterparts. There's a lot of really positive remarks about how this disaster is going to improve U.S.-Japanese relations, how it's showing that these two nations can partner, can be allies, can be friends and really equals in this response. And there's a lot of hope among diplomats on the scene, especially that this will lead to long-term improvements in U.S.-Japanese relations, at least initially. ...
Yeah, it's a great case study, as many of these are, a great case study, because it does, again, show the influence of the personalities as well as these strategic points. But the bigger legacy for the organizations themselves seems to have been the Second World War, that in the aftermath of the Second World War, there appeared to be more of a, for lack of a better word, a centralization of U.S. foreign disaster assistance. Talk through that. What did the experience of World War II give to the American government and American people when it came to this? And how did that manifest in the years and decades after in terms of how it organized itself to meet these needs?
Mm-hmm. Kind of leading up to World War II, in the aftermath of the Great Kanto earthquake in 1923, the U.S. government and military and Red Cross continue providing assistance much as they had before. There's a lot of sort of similarities to the early 20th century. There are more disaster relief efforts kind of more frequently. They're becoming kind of more routine and a routine part of U.S. foreign relations. But there's a lot of kind of similarities. The Red Cross is still providing much of the funding, much of the kind of oversight. The State Department is still taking the lead, but often, you know, for the most part, it's sort of these shorter term relief efforts, and not more longer, the sort of longer term reconstruction efforts are rarer and fewer and far between. What changes in World War II is, in a lot of ways, World War II, I think, is a, it's World War One to the extreme, right? So all of the things I mentioned in World War One happen even more so, far more so, arguably, in World War Two. You see this massive expansion of the U.S. military, and unlike in World War One, when the U.S. military kind of reverts to a much smaller peacetime footing, this isn't going to happen after World War Two. The U.S. military does demobilize and become smaller, but then the onset of the Cold War in the late 1940s essentially encourages and propels a remilitarization of the United States. What one scholar has called the warfare state essentially becomes a permanent condition. The U.S. military goes from having, I think it's like something like 14 overseas military bases to, at the end of the war, owning or having access rights to 2,000 military bases and installations around the world. This number will shrink and then kind of fluctuate. But essentially, the U.S. military is what some have called a basing empire, or it's an empire of bases, is really, doesn't go away after World War II. And it has this footprint all over the world that it didn't have before. The State Department expands in size, and simply the U.S. government's role in the world is just much larger than it had been. So you have a lot of ambassadors, you have a lot of diplomats, consuls stationed all over the world in numbers that they hadn't before, who are much more involved in foreign affairs generally. The American Red Cross continues to play a major role in U.S. international aid and international disaster aid. But one of the other interesting elements of World War II is that you have a lot of other organizations appear on the scene. Some of them are older, some of them are newer. NGOs like CARE, Church World Service, Catholic Relief Services. These organizations do a lot of work during the Second World War. And they, like the Red Cross, forge these partnerships with the U.S. government that are really mutually beneficial. These organizations get from the U.S. government access to things like surplus commodities and free subsidies to help them ship aid abroad. And the U.S. government, in turn, gets these organizations who are willing to work with the government to discuss shared goals with the State Department to ensure that they're fulfilling U.S. national security interests in other places. And these organizations will continue to work with the government in the aftermath of World War II in a sort of new partnership that expands the U.S. government's essentially number of voluntary partners out there. So all of these changes just make essentially enable the United States to respond to disasters much more quickly, much more with a lot more funding, with a lot more assistance than they ever had before, even in the early 20th century. So it really does transform the United States' humanitarian power, as well as its other forms of world power.
I think that when a lot of people consider U.S. foreign aid in general, but specifically disaster assistance now, one of the first things that comes to mind is USAID, the Agency for International Development. But that did not exist 100 years ago. When did USAID come to be? How has it shifted organizationally in the last several decades? And how does it relate to other organizations that grew up and popped down and evolved after World War II?
So USAID was founded in 1961, and its creation is in chapter 12 of 13 in this book. So one of the things I really want to make an argument here in this book is that the U.S. government's involvement in foreign aid, foreign disaster aid, but really foreign aid more broadly, well predates not only USAID, but also the Marshall Plan, these other kinds of things that we often think of as foundational moments in U.S. foreign aid. So USAID is founded in 1961, but it's not the first U.S. federal aid agency. After World War II, there are actually attempts to, there's a sort of sense that the U.S. government should be more involved in foreign aid, that there should be this kind of permanent part of the U.S. government that is doing foreign assistance, that this longstanding reliance on the American Red Cross to essentially be the U.S. government's foreign aid arm is maybe a bit outdated, and that the government should have more control over aid itself. So this begins with, we see, for instance, the Marshall Plan, the European Recovery Program, and then shortly thereafter in 1949, something that's called the Point 4 Program. This is known because Harry Truman, in his 1949 inaugural, it was the fourth point in his speech, but it became known as Point 4. Point 4 was the earliest kind of technical assistance, or what we might call development assistance, project for the U.S. So both the Marshall Plan and Point 4 are really early post-war foreign aid organizations, and there's a bureaucracy kind of surrounding them. But by the time we get to the 1950s, under the Eisenhower administration, there's two different organizations. The first is the Foreign Operations Administration, and then the International Cooperation Administration, which is founded in 1955. And this is really, these are the precursors, essentially, to USAID. So you have this experimentation with these federal aid agencies during the 1950s. And then when the Kennedy administration comes in, there's a sense that there's a lot of problems with them. There's debates over where the aid should go, who has control. So USAID is kind of Kennedy's attempt to fix all of these issues and really centralize non-military foreign assistance under one agency.
Before you go on, am I right that all of those organizations were in some way linked to the State Department? They weren't completely independent, but they were linked in various fashions to diplomatic leadership.
Yeah, and it changes for each of them, right? And this is actually one of the major debates about like how closely linked should USAID or other USAID and its predecessors be to the State Department. And there's a lot of debates within among policymakers over this. A lot of people in the foreign aid field want to be as separate as possible from the State Department, right? Believing that humanitarian assistance should not be dictated by national security concerns, but rather by real humanitarian concerns. And then on the other hand, there are those, especially within the State Department and Congress, who think that foreign aid is absolutely about national security, and that that USAID needs to be much closer and sort of under the wing of the State Department. So these are major debates that are kind of going on in the 50s and early 60s about, what USAID should do, how it should be operating, what its mission really is, and whose interests it should be serving, the U.S. governments or populations in need of aid. So this is kind of part of those debates. USAID is created as a sort of semi-autonomous agency. So it's not just straight under the State Department, right, but has a lot more autonomy than some of its predecessors as well.
Eventually, and this is kind of the big gotcha of this whole conversation, eventually the United States government gets around to actually making all of this clearly legal. And that is to say that there have been, congressional authorizations of funds for disaster relief. There's been the setup of funds for diplomats to use at their discretion. There's been immense deference to the executive in many cases to pursue national interests through foreign disaster assistance. But it's not until 1975 that there's actually a clear piece of legislation governing this, right?
Yeah. And one of the quotes that made me laugh out loud when I came across it in the archives, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember exactly, but at some point in the 1950s, a U.S. military commander is talking in this meeting, and he says, the U.S. military is accused of breaking a lot of laws, But I don't think we ever break so many laws as when we do disaster relief operations. It's this really, really remarkable kind of observation, which is absolutely true. There's this sort of, there isn't the kind of legislative authority for a lot of what is happening in this book isn't clear cut. So starting in the 60s and into the early 70s, there's a sense that disaster relief is something that the U.S. government does. It's a norm. It's happened for decades. And there should be more effort to really codify this in federal law. So the first Foreign Assistance Act in 1961, which is really we continue to operate, foreign aid continues to operate under updated and revised and amended versions of the Foreign Assistance Act. So it's created in 1961, the same year as USAID. It takes until 1975 before there is a chapter on international disaster assistance that is actually added to the Foreign Assistance Act. So before then, they're kind of figuring out how to, they're operating, right, obviously in the world without this specific language. But there's a lot of push from people within USAID to kind of have this language added. And so this happens in 1975, and late in the year, they finally get this this chapter that really outlines the U.S. government's responsibilities and various the responsibilities of various parts of the U.S. federal government when international disasters occur. And so this is this kind of interesting moment that we really see it made part of a federal law.
So bringing this up to the current day, there's a few things that, reflecting on your research and writing occur to me, and I'd love to get your take on these thoughts. First of all, there is something that I'm not sure it's historically unique, but it certainly is much more dramatic in the last couple of decades than anything I see in the longer history that you've uncovered. And that is, we saw it most prominently with former Presidents Bush and Clinton doing the international relief for Haiti and then other things around the world, including the tsunami in the Indian Ocean. We saw it in 2017 when most of the former and living presidents went to Texas A&M to do a huge fundraiser for the triple hurricanes of Harvey, Irma, and Maria. I don't recall James Madison in his post-presidency doing a lot of fundraising for American private organizations and relief organizations, but it seems like that's become the norm since the 1990s in particular. So I'd like your take on that, both in terms of how interesting that is as a historian seeing that development, but what it points out that it's still U.S. government affiliated figures, former, yes, but U.S. government affiliated celebrities, but raising money for private efforts to aid with foreign disasters.
Yeah, no, that's a really fantastic observation. And I'm interested in it as well. I mean, I will say, while sort of former presidents weren't necessarily doing this quite as much in the 20th century, the period in my book, there are a lot of examples of sitting presidents raising money or trying to raise money, especially for the American Red Cross, but for other organizations as well. So when disasters happen, there's a lot of presidential proclamations by most of the sitting presidents urging the American public to donate money to the American Red Cross, mm-hmm. To come to the aid, because so much of this foreign assistance is not funded through taxpayer dollars, especially early on, but through the donations of the American public. So you do have kind of presidents urging the American public to act, using their kind of that official capacity to encourage that, not just to give to the government, but to give to private causes as well. I think the sort of afterlives of presidencies, part of it is that presidents are living longer, right, and they have more time to kind of have this sort of post-presidential legacy that you're mentioning too. It's interesting, I think, and it goes back to this idea that disaster relief, especially, is often seen as bipartisan and apolitical in this way that other types of U.S. international involvement are not. And I think that this moment of like coming together, bringing again Bush and Clinton together to fundraise is really kind of they wouldn't necessarily be doing this for victims of a conflict, right, or for other kinds of international affairs in a way that it's so much easier for us to imagine them doing this in times of, mm-hmm. of disaster. And that tells us something about the kind of special nature that we think about disasters.
Another thing that I want to get your take on is that there is this belief that, you know, looking back at this history, especially some of the earlier cases, you know, it seems so quaint, right? It's this ambassador, sometimes virtually alone in the country, and, you know, getting out there and putting hands on the situation and personally managing this. And oh, how silly those old times were, where we had to deal with issues of, you know, domestic restraint and local realities and inadequate mechanisms. And yet we're dealing with those same things today. It's on a different scale, but it's not as if there is a magic perfect solution for how to handle a natural disaster and foreign aid relief. So how much do you think we collectively, as a government, as a society, how much have we learned about how to do this best?
That's a great question. You know, I think one of the sort of universal truths about disasters, right, is that they are not simple events. They are very complex events, and as much as you plan for these events, there's still so many sort of unexpected things that happen. They are these contingencies. Even if you know that a disaster is likely to occur in a certain place, you don't know. You know, you don't really know when that earthquake will strike or what damage it will cause or who will be affected or what the multiple sort of ripple effects will be. I do think, you know, in the late 20th, early 21st century, there's a lot more expertise and awareness and ability to kind of plan, not only in the U.S. government, but certainly, especially within the international community. So there's, you know, in the last 50 years or so, there's just been so much more focus within the UN and its agencies, as well as other international NGOs, on issues of not only disaster relief, but what's called disaster risk reduction. So taking steps ahead of time to mitigate the risks of disaster, to help people prepare for disasters, which does save a lot of lives, you know, in the long term. So these are things that we don't often see. Preparedness isn't headline grabbing, right? This idea that you're preparing for something is not a headline grabbing as these sort of major death tolls following sure. disasters, but it's incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of behind the scenes work is ensuring that fewer people do die or are injured when disasters happen, that there is less destruction. Mm-hmm. But obviously, as our headlines tell us, these things continue, right? So we have not figured out how to solve or resolve all of these problems by any stretch of the imagination. And in some ways, things have become more complicated. You know, there's an ease, I think, the sort of quaint earlier version that you're discussing of a few people on the ground who are making these decisions. The landscape now, if a major disaster occurs, there's dozens, if not hundreds, of voluntary organizations from different countries, from, you know, some are faith-based, some are secular, some are representing governments, some are not, some are representing the UN, and the kind of crowded nature of that scene can make coordination much more difficult. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the challenges, I think, of coordination that we run into these days too.
I'd like to close the substance here by looping back to something you brought up near the beginning about the cultural side of this, that, you know, just you shake your head when you think that did they really make a roller coaster out of the disaster in Martinique?
They really did.
Because it seems an extraordinarily bad taste. I mean, imagine in our times, if there were a water park that made a ride out of the Japanese tsunami, it just feels wrong. Yeah. But it does point to that issue in the manner in which you raised it, which is some of these disasters really resonate with people more than others. And I have yet to find a great pattern, right? It's not always the ones that occur in the countries where the greatest number of Americans find their heritage. It's not always about the ones that are geographically most proximate. I'm wondering if you've seen any pattern in cultural resonance of these disasters, and then in the way that they are portrayed, whether in media or in more wide pop culture like amusement rides.
Yeah. This book would have been much easier to write if I could have found a pattern in some ways. Because yeah, I mean, this was really something that I struggled with a lot too. And it's a question people have sort of asked. And I think it's a, you know, what is the, if I were a political scientist, I would probably need a much more clear theory on this. But as a historian, I get to say things are messy and complicated. But I think, you know, it's really one of the things that really struck me about this book is that it's really hard to predict which crises will capture the imagination and which will not. And it is this combination of factors. A lot of times, you know, an affinity to a place, you know, if people have this sense of connection, that certainly motivates it. A lot of times I think it's, you know, if it's a slow news day, if there's not other things going on and people are paying attention, that helps them kind of be aware. Certainly the levels of death and destruction, and I think the suddenness of that event do kind of capture people's imaginations. And that tells us, you know, something about, I think, the sort of the ways that people imagine these sudden disasters, as opposed to, say, a long drawn out drought or famine that has much slower sort of effects. So I think all of these play a role, but there's also just sort of no predicting which disasters will really capture people's attention and which will not. And that's a really, it's a, you know, challenging thing for historians, but also for aid workers today, right? How do you combat what people call compassion fatigue, and make sure that when the next disaster happens, people are paying attention and aren't simply tuned out because they've been paying too much attention to other things happening in the world?
Do you have any disaster movies or books or other forms of art that you actually like, or are you repulsed by them and find them to be too trite?
I find them fascinating. You know, I watched early on in this, I decided to watch Waterworld because I'd never watched it. And you know, it's as bad as you think or as you remember. Yeah. So
it's definitely an experience. I love the idea behind the movie. It's one of those where the concept is interesting, but I don't like the way they play the story out at all.
No. I felt like I was doing research watching it though. So, I find this sort of, the disasters really, they are, I think the disaster film genre is such a, it was really big in the 70s and 80s, but certainly we see, things like Asteroid, and this obsession with this story of disaster, I think is really common. So I don't tend to watch all that many disaster movies. I am intrigued by sort of disaster art. There's really some beautiful, the Great Kanto earthquake, for instance, just the outpouring, like beautiful, beautiful art from Japanese artists at the time, really trying to make sense of this catastrophe and its effects. And so, these beautiful like woodblock prints that kind of come out of this, they really capture people's, just the emotion that you can kind of see in some of this art is really striking. So, I think there are these sort of moments of people trying to make sense of tragedy through art that are really beautiful in this kind of timeless sort of way. Sure. That are kind of pretty amazing.
Well, let me reach into our chatterbox to ask you one of our questions here. Julia, who is someone in your field or a related one whose work more people should be following?
Oh, that is a very good question. Oh, there's so many that I want to highlight. So, the work of Jacob Remus, who wrote a wonderful book on two major disasters that occurred, one in Halifax, a major explosion, and then one in the Northeast United States, and the kind of connections in the early 20th century. This is kind of between people in Canada and the United States, and the emotional connections they felt.
Oh, wow.
He looks a lot at this question of solidarity. So whereas my book is looking especially top down, this sort of sense of like what the U.S. government is doing, what major officials are doing, he's looking at working class people and the ways that they looked out for one another. Both within their own communities, but also the kind of connections they forged with other working class people across the border because of their shared experience with disaster, because of their shared experience with condescending relief workers. And I think this kind of this ground level bottom up story that he tells is a really beautiful look at disaster survivors and the ways that they empower themselves in the aftermath of catastrophe. So that is one book I would certainly point to.
That is a great one. We will provide a link to that in our show notes. Julia, I want to thank you for spending so much time, talking through your work and its implications for writing Catastrophic Diplomacy, the history of U.S. foreign disaster assistance, but also for writing Making the World Safe about the American Red Cross. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. And thank you for the conversation. I really enjoyed it.
That was Chatter,
a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at @ThatWasChatter.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.